In Adventures in Orgasmatron, How the Sexual Revolution Came to America, Christopher Turner tells the story of Wilhelm Reich, the eccentric and misunderstood Austrian-American psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. Reich had been an early admirer of Freud, and he believed that sex education and a mysterious orgone energy could reform society. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Turner, who writes for The Guardian and the London Review of Books and is an editor at Cabinet Magazine, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
You're British. Is William Reich's story well known in the UK?
It is quite well known, but his primary influence was in America. But what attracted me to him was that he brought European ideas to America. He came here in 1939, just before the outbreak of the Second World War, bringing these ideas about sex that had kind of fermented in Europe to America's shores.
Well, he wasn't the only person who was escaping the Nazis who came here, and a fair number of psychotherapists, psychoanalysts came here, followers of Freud. But he was a little different, wasn't he? Had he studied with Freud?
He had. He'd been one of the brightest of Freud's second generation of pupils. And he was thought to be Freud's heir apparent at one stage. But he had this very eccentric theory of the orgasm, where he thought that a satisfactory orgasm made the difference between sickness and health. And he went on and on and on about this theory to Freud's horror. And Freud called it his personal hobby horse, and that was what kind of really made a split between him and Freud, as well as Reich's communism.
So did he think that if a sociopath had a good orgasm, that he was being healthy?
Yes, he thought that sexual repression led to, the sociopath being a sociopath.
Well, Freud also talked a lot about sexual repression. So just Reich was taking it a bit further?
Well, Freud thought that some degree of repression was inherent to the human condition, but Reich thought that repression could be completely thrown off to lead what his critics dismissed as a genital utopia.
Reich coined the phrase the sexual revolution, and although he died in 1957, do you think the 60s in the United States turned out to be what he had envisioned?
I think he would have been very disappointed with, how the 60s turned out. He was surprisingly Puritan. He believed in love over, free sex, a sex epidemic, orgies, that kind of thing. He believed very much in love. And
He did sleep with his patients.
He did. He slept with several of his patients. And he was, he was sexually radical. But the 60s would have disappointed him because it was much more about commerce than political ideals.
And he believed that sex could really reform society.
Yeah. He basically fused communism and psychoanalysis, and it was that fusion which led to this sexual theory that, sex could somehow regenerate society, free sex could regenerate society.
Well, it was the same idea that the Surrealists had, wasn't it? That you could combine psychoanalysis and politics. They were mostly communists. But was he really a communist? Wasn't he just kind of like a fellow traveler type?
No, he was a very militant communist for a while. He, marched in the streets in Berlin. He was in a communist cell with Arthur Koestler in Berlin. Hmm. And, he was a militant communist. And that's what led to his exile with Freud, because Freud wanted to detach psychoanalysis from politics.
So how did the Communist Party feel about him when he started becoming famous?
Well, they threw him out of the Communist Party in 1934, partly because he was a psychoanalyst, and the communists mistrusted psychoanalysis because that was all about the individual. And they were interested in, collective revolutionary change. So they threw him out because he was advocating these, sex clubs for adolescents. He thought they had a right to free sexual expression. And the Communist Party thought that he was turning their youth groups into bordellos.
Didn't he also have some influence, some Nazi party thinking?
No, he was he was Jewish, a psychoanalyst and a communist, everything the Nazis hated. But he found himself on a Nazi watch list, and his apartment was under watch. It was raided a few times. His patients were investigated. A few of his friends were tortured to death in military prison. And he was basically hounded across Europe by the Nazis. He left in 1933 when Hitler came to power in Germany, and kind of, first of all, went to Vienna and then through Scandinavia as fascism spread across Europe.
While he was working as the director of the technical seminar of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society in the mid-1920s, he wrote Character Analysis. And that was a pretty important book at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, and it stayed an important book for a long time. It was on a lot of training lists for training analysts, a lot of reading lists for training analysts for a long time.
There's a phrase, interpret character before content, that comes out of that book. And that's something that people still say today.
Yeah.
But is that something that Freud thought was a good idea?
Freud was interested in all these therapeutic innovations, but, you know, he was quite traditional. He thought that, you know, you should let the patient talk and it should be a kind of slow process. He had his beard shaven off because of his cancer in the jaw. And he said, you know, it took 3 months for my beard to grow back. You know, why should an analysis be a speedy thing? But Reich was very impatient. He wanted, you know, character analysis. It's about kind of confronting the patient with their flaws. And, you know, that was a result of his own impatient character.
And did it work? Did people feel it sped things up? Because psychoanalysis could drag on for years and years and years. And some people said, well, it never ended unless you finally decided you were bored by it.
Well, everyone said that Reich's interpretations of people's character were incredibly perceptive. He could narrow in on a weak spot very immediately. But they also found it, you know, patients found it very aggressive. And, you know, it made them defensive. And later on, Reich, after the psychoanalytic party threw him out, he invented this new form of therapy, which he called vegetotherapy, which consisted of kind of, well, his wife said it dispensed with the psychoanalytic taboo of not touching the patient and substituted it with a physical attack by the therapist. And Reich would literally, you know, dig his thumbs into the patient's body to try and manipulate, to try and free the sexual, the repression that he could see congealed in the body. And I submitted to that therapy, and I can certainly say that it's an incredibly painful experience.
Not like Rolfing?
Well, I've never been Rolfed, but a lot of Reich's disciples used to pride themselves in, you know, how their patients were covered in bruises. Mm-hmm. And you really have to, you know, that obviously with psychoanalysis, there's the transference. You know, you kind of, there's this kind of like magic in the relationship. But this, you know, this technique involved the patient submitting physically and intellectually to the analyst. So it's a very, very, you know, it's kind of seductive relationship.
Well, you also had a concept of character armor. Now, if you had armor on, I guess that would protect you against what he was doing. But how did he address character armor in his patients?
Well, you know, when he was giving them this rigorous massage, that was to dissolve character armor. You know, he thought there were bodily chinks that he could see within the body, and he would try and release those so there was like free flow of energy to the genitals, basically. Therapy should result in what he called the orgasm reflex, the satisfactory apocalyptic orgasm.
Didn't Freud interrupt one of Reich's lectures?
There was a moment where Reich stuttered and failed to deliver a lecture because he was reading from notes. And I think maybe that's the incidents you're referring to.
Well, he believed that how patients act is as relevant as how they what they say, which makes perfect sense today. But that's something that Freud didn't subscribe to.
Freud subscribed to the idea of acting out. Mm. So I don't think that actions were not important for Freud. It wasn't just an intellectual process.
When did Reich come up with the idea of the orgone box and orgone energy?
When he was in Norway, he'd been persecuted around Scandinavia. You know, people were very suspicious of his sexual theories, and the authorities had ejected him from Denmark and Sweden, and he ended up in Norway. And there he was basically a paranoid mess. You know, he felt completely cornered in Europe as fascism was kind of ready to pounce one last time. He had nowhere left to go. And there he had a kind of schizoid experience where he thought that he discovered the origins of life in this primordial soup that he made in the laboratory. And he thought that there was this radiation given off by this suit, which he could concentrate in a Faraday cage. And after he came to America, he came to the conclusion that this energy that he thought originated in this soup was everywhere in the atmosphere. And he invented the orgone box, which was a kind of more elaborate version of the Faraday cage, to concentrate it.
So you're suggesting that he had a breakdown?
I definitely think he had a breakdown.
Was this apparent to the people around him?
Well, a lot of his psychoanalytic friends thought he was schizophrenic. And, you know, the period in which he became schizophrenic was pushed ever back. You know, one of his therapists said that he was schizophrenic in the most serious way in the early 1930s. But this schizoid experience that I'm talking about happened in the late 30s.
Well, then people might be a little afraid to go to a therapist who's crazier than they are. Yeah. What happened when patients came to him? Was he able to mask this?
Well, he was manic depressive. So he would have these manic episodes in which he would make all these discoveries like orgone energy. And then he would have these depressive episodes in which he would consolidate those discoveries and incorporate them into his pre-existing theories. So people, certainly his patients, did find him eccentric. You know, at some stages he charged one of his patients with a pair of antlers, and on another occasion he offered the patient a gun and suggested they shoot him. You know, he was certainly an unconventional analyst, but they all had a tremendous respect for his analytic experience.
Oh, and they believed in him. Many people got the... Did he have an orgone box in his office, or did you have to go buy one and put it in your home?
No, he did have an orgone box in his office, and he advocated that his patients used it alongside therapy, and, you know, that they sit in it every day for half an hour. And you could either buy them off him, or you could build your own. And in fact, for this event I'm doing tonight, someone here is building an orgone box, especially for the event. So,
and what do you do to build an orgone box? How do you get the orgone in it?
Well, the orgone box is, it's just basically a wooden box the size of a small telephone booth. And it's lined with sheet metal and the stuffed with rock and steel wool in alternate layers. And for some reason, the orgone can penetrate the metal but not escape. Wright was never quite sure how that happened, and you know, his explanations were never convincing. But he admitted that it looked like an unimpressive cabinet. But he said, you know, don't be deceived, its effect is very strong.
And he even made small ones. I remember people had orgone boxes they could stick their fingers into because it was supposed to do more than just free you sexually. It could cure cancer, people said, and do all sorts of other things.
Yeah, Wright did think... Initially, that it could cure cancer. And he actually, he persuaded Einstein to test the box for a while. You know, Einstein conducted 2 weeks of tests on this device, which is how I would say his hair began to stick up. But Einstein sort of disproved the box, his claims for the box. He thought that the box, a rise in temperature would occur within the box without somebody sitting there, which was totally against the laws of physics. It was kind of a free energy machine for Reich. And Einstein noticed that it was a result of, you know, convection and currents of air in the room that resulted in this temperature rise. And Wright was incredibly upset by that rebuffal, and he started treating cancer patients. And he was sure that he was helping them. You know, he wasn't able to save them in a large number of cases because they were coming to him so late. But he thought if you sat in the box, it would stop you getting cancer.
Well, some people were real believers, like William Steig, the cartoonist. But a lot of people sat in the box. Norman Mailer, Jack Kerouac, Sean Connery.
William Burroughs, who claimed to have had a spontaneous orgasm in the box, hands-free, he said. I interviewed Norman Mailer about his box, and he admitted to me that, you know, he thought the box was kind of crap. But he made an interesting comparison. He said it was a bit like shelters people had in their basements in case of atomic attack. He said the box was a bit like that. It was a fad, and people after 10 years became a little bit embarrassed that they had one. But I thought that was interesting. The box was a kind of Cold War relic.
And then Woody Allen made fun of it in the film Sleeper.
Yeah.
But people were starting to make fun of it at the time.
Yeah, I think people...
They saw this as a bit of a cult?
Yeah, well, it was certainly a fad, and it was a fad that attracted a certain left-wing type who were disaffected communists and Trotskyites. You know, they were looking for some new ideology. And Reich, you know, who was an emigre and opponent of the Nazis, kind of came with a philosophy that appealed to them. You know, it was a philosophy of sex and, you know, sexual freedom. And they embraced that wholeheartedly. But what interested me about the box was, why would people try and throw off their sexual repressions by climbing into a closet? You know, what does it tell us about the ironies of the sexual revolution, that the symbol of freedom is a box that you sit in alone, is claustrophobic, armored space?
Well, did its popularity last much past Reich's death in 1957?
Well, actually, Norman Mailer helped revive Reich's influence. And certainly in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of people were interested in his theories again. You know, he became an intellectual martyr type of the Cold War.
Well, in the late 1940s, there was a freelance writer named Mildred Edie Brady who wrote an article called The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich. And that kind of undermined a lot of his credibility, didn't it? What did she write?
Well, she also wrote an article called The New Cult of Sex and Anarchy, where she held up Reich as the leader of this new cult. And I think the authorities became very nervous. You know, he became a bit of a scapegoat for that sexual movement that they were noticing on the east and west coasts amongst bohemians and beatniks.
Well, there was also Esalen. Was he linked to Esalen in any way?
Esalen's was a bit later. But he was certainly linked to the kind of shanty town that spread along the Pacific coast, you know, Henry Miller and Kenneth Rex Ross, that kind of anarchist community that spilled out of San Francisco. You know, they all read his books. His books, as he once said, were selling like hotcakes out there.
And the article by Mildred Edie Brady claimed that Reich's followers were kind of like members of a cult. And she said that they needed to be dealt with. Did she have any real cause for concern?
Well, she was a consumer advocate. You know, she worked for the Consumers Union, and she thought that Reich was selling a cancer cure, and that was certainly something that should be investigated. And as a result of her article, the Food and Drug Administration did begin an investigation into Reich and his claims for the box, and that went on for several years. And I think one estimate I read, it cost $2 million for them to investigate this machine.
Well, they arrested him. The FBI arrested him first in 1941, and then he was released and imprisoned again in 1957.
Yeah, it was a bit of a tragic story, his first arrest, because they arrested him because they suspected that he was a communist and a Nazi.
A communist and a Nazi?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, because he had a German name.
He had a German name. So he found himself, you know, on Ellis Island with all these Nazis, which was obviously very frightening to him. But they had actually, the FBI had got him muddled up with this other man called William Reich, who actually did run a party bookstore in New Jersey and, you know, was a kind of undercover communist. And he actually went on to, you know, he was involved in, you know, Trotsky's assassination.
But then why was Reich arrested the second time in 1957? Because of the Orgone box?
He was imprisoned as a result of selling a fraudulent cancer cure. You know, they insisted, the FDA took out an injunction which said that he had to destroy all the boxes, stop selling any literature that advertised the boxes, which was his entire catalogue of books, because they all mentioned orgone energy. And Reich, by this stage, was, you know, quite unhinged. He felt persecuted again.
Well, he was being persecuted.
Yeah, he was.
There are other people who have claimed to have cures for cancer who don't go to jail.
Yeah. But by that time, he was really out in space, as he himself admitted. He had invented this cloudbuster machine with which he was shooting down UFOs and thinking that he could influence the weather with. And, you know, by the time he broke the injunction, you know, he was... You know, one of the prison psychiatrists said that he was psychotic, but the authorities couldn't admit that because it was an embarrassment to them that it spent so much money prosecuting him for this cancer cure. They didn't want to, you know, have a psychotic on their hands.
And he died in prison.
He did. He died in prison of a heart attack.
But he shouldn't have been in jail at that point. Could they have ever have just simply switched him over to a mental hospital? I mean, today, our prisons in this country largely
serve the functions of mental hospitals. But in those days, there were two separate entities.
Yeah, well, he did die just a few days before a parole hearing, so you know they might have let him out. And he did have plans to move to Switzerland with his last partner.
Christopher Turner will be appearing at the book launch party tonight at 7 o'clock at Cabinet Magazine's event space. That's at 300 Nevin Street in Brooklyn. And as an added enticement, there'll be a real orgone accumulated there. Are you going to have a box?
Yeah.
The one that you said you're building.
The gentleman who's building the box at the moment, a professor at Pratt, says he's pimping it out as we speak. So I'm about to go and collect it, and people will be able to try it out.
And then find out whether it works later. Well, you know, to some degree, it might very well, because there is that placebo effect. Well, maybe it really works.
Yeah, well, it seemed to work for William Burroughs.
Christopher Turner's book is Adventures in the Orgasmatron, How the Sexual Revolution Came to America. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.